At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Boy, I'm glad that's over, huh? All the turmoil over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the hand-wringing over high oil prices. Nice to have all that behind us, isn't it? Nah, I'm just kidding. It sure was fun to imagine, but the problem is that everybody is acting like it's true. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 17th of July. It's day Thursday. So good to have you with us. If you think something's going to be really lousy, and it only turns out to be a little bit lousy, then it's actually good, right? That particular bit of self-deception played big on Wall Street today. The topic was corporate profit reports, and the phrase of the day was better than expected. Marketplace's Amy Scott puts it all into context.
Profits at J.P. Morgan Chase fell 53% in the second quarter, but investors cheered. The stock rose to its highest level in more than a month and brought other bank stocks along for the ride. A similar thing happened yesterday with Wells Fargo. That's because analysts had predicted worse news from the banks.
On any given day, the stock market isn't reacting necessarily to the news of the day. It's reacting to the news relative to what was expected.
Jim Paulson is chief investment strategist at Wells Capital Management.
The expectations have gotten so bad that even bad news, what would have been bad news, you know, 3, 4, 5 months ago, is now good news because it isn't as bad as they feared.
Investors also got a dose of real good news today. The price of oil fell below $130 a barrel for the first time in a month. Bill O'Grady is head of investment strategy at Wachovia Securities. He says lower oil prices mean lower inflation, and that means the Federal Reserve can hold off on raising interest rates.
If inflation concerns are going to abate a bit, this kind of allows the Federal Reserve to wait longer to make its next move, which will probably be to raise rates.
O'Grady says this stock market rally could have legs if oil keeps sliding, but there could be plenty of bumps along the way as more financial firms come clean on their second quarter credit losses. After the markets closed, Merrill Lynch reported a worse than expected loss for the quarter. Citigroup is up tomorrow. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Financials, as Amy said, were driving things on Wall Street today and may well be again tomorrow. But some bank customers have been left feeling like they've been run over. IndyMac customers have had an especially rough week. Many depositors have had to wait for hours to get their money out of the collapsed bank. But now that they finally do have checks in hand, their problems aren't necessarily over, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
It's not often that banks turn away money, but some IndyMac depositors have found certain banks don't want their business. William Rubery is spokesman for the Office of Thrift Supervision. It regulates federal savings banks.
We're just hearing some complaints about IndyMac bank checks either not being honored or taking longer than they should to clear.
Washington Mutual has reportedly turned away people with IndyMac checks or told them the checks would take up to 8 weeks to clear. Just days ago, representatives from Washington Mutual were handing out business cards to people waiting in line to withdraw their money from IndyMac. John Bovenzi is acting chief executive officer at the bank. He's been trying to restore trust in IndyMac now that it's been taken over by the FDIC.
I've personally talked with the heads of some of the banks to get them to reduce those hold times, and we've just set up a phone line that those banks can call if they have any question about one of our customers' checks.
He says the issue will be turned over to banking regulators. Ed Merzwinski is a consumer advocate with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. He says banks that won't respect checks backed by the FDIC have a double standard.
These banks ought to walk outside and look at the window and see the sign that says they're FDIC insured.
IndyMac customers could save themselves some hassle and leave their money where it is. Now that the FDIC is taking control, Bovenzi says IndyMac is as safe as any bank in the country. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
There's a new force to be reckoned with in the world of pharmaceuticals, and its name is the William J. Clinton Foundation. The former president announced a deal this morning that could stabilize prices for drugs to treat the 500 million people a year who get malaria. Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
One of the best defenses we have against malaria these days comes from a fern-like weed called Sweet Annie or wormwood. Fluctuating supply and demand have pushed the plant compound's price from $155 per kilo 1 year to over $1,000 the next. The Clinton Foundation deal sets price ceilings for the compound with six world suppliers. And Steve Meshnick at the University of North Carolina says that'll make the drugs cheaper.
The less expensive the drugs are, the more people can be treated. And even now, the drugs are still too expensive.
The price probably wouldn't go down anytime soon without the foundation's help. Right now, Novartis is the largest producer of antimalarials. CEO Daniel Vecella says the company sold 66 million treatments last year, but lost millions on the sales.
We decided it is part of our purpose in society to also deliver medications where we may not make a profit.
But other companies may not go out on a limb for drugs that don't hold a potential payoff. Les Funtleiter is an analyst at Miller Tabak.
Some of the pharmaceutical companies do feel a social responsibility to do that. But in general, you don't want to make too many decisions that are economically negative.
Suppliers that are part of the Clinton Foundation effort will also receive other incentives, like marketing help. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the past week's wailing over Fannie and Freddie was quickly forgotten. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Liberal online politics has a very real-world location this week. 2,000 left-of-center bloggers have descended on Austin, Texas for something called Netroots Nation, and they are riding high. Blogging is where a whole lot of politics is playing out this election cycle. Barack Obama has proved you can raise a ton of campaign money online, but what about raising ad revenues? We asked Marketplace's John Dimsdale whether bloggers might be able to become entrepreneurs.
Political blogs are going mainstream. According to a survey by the Pew Internet and American Life Project, 46% of Americans use the Internet to keep up on politics and politicians. The most popular sites are visited by hundreds of thousands of readers. They include Daily Kos, Huffington Post, and Instapundit. Blogs may be a great way to solicit donations from the political faithful, but
I find it really hard to believe that people are going to make the jump from ideology to commerce.
Jeff Gregory is president of Brand Council, a business strategy consulting firm. Even though some political blogs are beginning to generate ad revenue, he doesn't expect big companies to start surfing the blogging wave anytime soon.
Advertisers are very sensitive to the kind of content that their ads are running beside. So if someone is really letting a candidate have it on a political blog, I am sure that a Fortune 1000 company is going to look at that and say, we don't want any part of that.
Besides, Gregory figures blog readers aren't likely to be receptive to online ads.
I think these folks are just too much political propeller heads to respond that well to advertising.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
I know there's still a credit squeeze going on and all, but if you happen to have a way to borrow a couple of $100 million, the NFL's got a deal for you. Maybe three of them, actually. The owners of the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Jacksonville Jaguars, and the St. Louis Rams are all said to be looking for buyers. Daniel Kaplan covers the finances of the NFL and its teams for the Sports Business Journal. Dan, good to talk to you.
Great to be here.
Is it unusual to have three teams in the league up for sale?
It's very unusual. Three teams have changed hands all of this decade, so it's extraordinarily unusual. And as the prices keep going up, there's a more and more limited pool of prospective buyers who can afford these things.
Let's run down some of those teams. The most storied, of course, the most well-known are the Pittsburgh Steelers. They're having some league problems and some family problems, right?
It's not necessarily league problems per se. The situation with the Steelers is they've been owned by the Rooney family since 1933. The five Rooney brothers own 80% of the team and each own 16%. Their cousins own 20%. Under NFL rules, the lead owner must have 30%, but the Rooneys have been exempted from that. So they've gone along swimmingly under this formula for a while, when suddenly some of the brothers' gambling interests in Florida decided to put in slot machines. And that runs afoul of NFL rules, and so they're requiring the brothers to sell. The problem is Dan Rooney, if he wants to buy out one of the brothers, would have to spend probably $160 million, which he certainly doesn't have.
And he's having problems getting the financing to buy out the rest of them?
There's a few issues there. He's trying to get the financing, but the brothers feel he is undervaluing the assets. The four other brothers have hired an investment bank, Goldman Sachs, to do their own valuation. The second thing you have is waiting in the wings is Stanley Druckenmiller, the famous hedge fund manager, perhaps best known for working with George Soros to make a run on the pound in the early 90s. And he's a Pittsburgh native, a diehard Steeler fan, and he'd like to buy the team. The thing that often gets overlooked in this is at the end of the day, it's the NFL that decides who owns this team. And if they want Dan Rooney at the end of the day to own it, I think Dan Rooney will own this team.
What about the other two teams, the Rams and the Jaguars?
Well, both the Rams and Jaguars are poking around the market. The Rams were inherited by their two current owners from their deceased mother earlier this year. The two owners will be facing a large estate tax bill. So they are looking at potentially selling the team, though they say they are not actively looking to sell it. The Jaguars are owned by Wayne Weaver, the founder of Nine West, and has long been thought to want to exit professional football, and he has been talking to potential buyers for several years now.
Granted, you've got appreciating asset values in these teams, but I'm wondering whether the credit squeeze and the financial crisis are having any impact on league finances and team finances.
Around the edges, mind you, the league is right now is in the midst of a big labor struggle. They have a labor crisis on the horizon, so they're going to put out a lot of rhetoric to that effect, that the economy is having a big effect. But I liken the NFL to Manhattan real estate. Is it completely immune to larger economic forces? No. But by and large, you're talking about a different animal.
Daniel Kaplan covers the NFL for Sports Business Journal. Dan, thanks a lot for your time.
No problem.
Coming up, take over the world with a click of the mouse.
You go from a single-cell organism to a creature, and then you go from a creature to a society of creatures, and then you go from a society to creatures to an interplanetary society that spans galaxies.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shot up 1.8%, 207 points to close at 11,446 today. The Nasdaq rose 1.2%, 27 points to finish at 2312. The S&P 500 climbed 0.9%, 11 points, ended at 1256. Shares of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac continued their long road back. Fannie Mae soared 18%. Freddie Mac jumped 22%. Some of the big financials recovered as well. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Wachovia all picked up healthy double-digit gains. Merrill Lynch, on the other hand, dropped 5% in after-hours trading after at least those earnings that Amy Scott was telling us about. Intel has investors feeling chipper after the company declared a quarterly cash dividend of 14 cents a share. Intel stock processed a gain of more than 5% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.03%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. The National Organization for Women kicks off its annual conference in Bethesda, Maryland. The late gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson was born on July 18, 1937. And it'll be a very late evening for cinema-goers when the clock strikes 12. In Gotham and beyond, the Dark Knight descends on theaters. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's 3 days in a row now that oil has taken a big spill. Crude dropped more than $5 today to finish at $129.29 a barrel. It's off almost 12% since Monday, mostly because of worries that a slowing U.S. economy is going to mean lower demand. Or so the conventional thinking goes, anyway. Figuring out why oil prices move the way they do is an inexact science at best. We've been trying to make some sense of the usual suspects this week, Iran, Venezuela, and Nigeria so far. Today we move up the list of big producers a bit. Nicholas Redmond's a Russia analyst with the Economist Intelligence Unit. Mr. Redmond, good to have you with us.
Good afternoon.
Basics first, I suppose. Where does Russia sit in the world oil market in terms of production and output?
In terms of production and output, it's number two behind Saudi Arabia. In terms of production, it's pretty much matching Saudi Arabia barrel for barrel, or has been for the past couple of years. But because it's a big domestic consumer, it's definitely at number two in the oil export market at about 5-6 million barrels a day.
There was a period of intense growth in the Russian oil economy in the 1990s, and that's sort of when it came to global consciousness as a key element of the oil industry. How did it get that growth, and what's happened since?
Growth plummeted in the Russian oil economy in the early 1990s and really through to the mid-1990s as a result of the chaos from Soviet Union's collapse. Between 1999 and 2005, that rose way up, 50% increase, absolutely astonishing recovery. Most of that was achieved, however, simply by more advanced extraction techniques at existing wells. Western Siberia, all the pipelines are from there, basically going west.
So if they want to grow anymore, they have to go to the Far East, which I imagine is more difficult.
The Far East and the Far North, and both are extremely difficult. And offshore, Russia doesn't have much experience of producing oil offshore.
Are they trying to do it all themselves, or are they inviting foreign oil companies in to help them out?
Well, here's the thing. A few years ago, foreign investment did play a fairly important role in the Russian oil sector as they were developing fields, and then the state bullied its way in and took a larger share in the projects. Today, what you have is a Russian oil industry in which the state has a much more direct grip. But if Russia does want to even maintain its share of the world export market, it's now time, or it will very soon be time, to move on to the Virgin Territories. Are the Russian companies equipped to take the job on? Because at the moment, the foreigners aren't really getting enough of an incentive or enough of a look in to play a meaningful role.
When you think about the internal Russian oil economy, are there government incentives for increasing production?
Well, they've recently delivered tax cuts, and oil companies have in return responded that they will now, after a year of stagnation, increase their output accordingly. It's a very difficult thing to do. The Russians' tax system on oil is effective, but it's blunt.
What are the numbers? How much tax are Russian oil companies paying?
Well, I mean, a huge amount, probably about 60% of total take-up. The way it works is that when the oil price per barrel goes above $27, $29, basically 90% of that revenue goes directly to the state in taxes.
And we're long past $27 and $29 a barrel.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
What about the impact on the Russian presence on the global oil market? I mean, you never hear on a day when oil spikes or plummets down to $5, $6. You never hear, oh, it's because the Russians did this or the Russians did that. I mean, do they play their presence in the oil markets heavily?
The Russians have had the option of joining OPEC for some time, but have never done so. They are pretty much a price taker. Generally, they're not a mover in the way that Saudi Arabia is, or even to an extent, someone like Venezuela or Nigeria. The slowdown in, or the interruptions that you've seen in those economies seems to have had a more direct effect on the oil price, certainly, than any news coming out of Russia.
Mr. Redmond, thanks very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Nicholas Redmond is a European analyst with the Economist Intelligence Unit. We reached him in London, England. When we talk about oil prices, it's usually a futures contract that we're talking about, an agreement to pay a prearranged price for a barrel of oil at some point in the future, hence future contract. The art of the deal, though, and the way to make money is to guess that future price of the world's most actively traded commodity. Commentator and economist Justin Wolfers thinks he's got it all figured out.
Important decisions about our family's finances, things like which car to purchase or where to choose to live. All of it hinges on whether today's high oil prices are here to stay or whether this is just a temporary blip. And there are dozens of talking heads on TV pontificating about the latest oil industry developments. But in fact, you're more of an expert than any of these talking heads. Or you will be when I give you my secret forecasting formula. Here it is. The single best forecast of oil prices in 1 month, 3 months, or a year is... today's oil price. With oil prices at exorbitant levels, I'm forecasting that next year's price will also be at exorbitant levels. I'm not saying the prices won't change, but I am saying they're about as likely to go up as they are to go down. Let's call this the no-change forecasting rule. It won't work for everything, but it does pretty well for oil prices. In fact, Ron Olquist and Lutz Killian, two University of Michigan economists, recently assessed the forecasting performance of the no-change rule. Amazingly, this simple rule did better than the average of dozens of professional forecasters. In fact, the no-change forecast was 34% more accurate at predicting oil prices in 3 months' time and 18% more accurate at predicting prices in a year's time. While professional prognosticators might argue that this difference isn't statistically significant, it sure is embarrassing. Others ignore the professional forecasters and focus instead on what futures markets are saying. But it turns out that even futures prices are not as accurate as our simple formula. Even sophisticated econometric models don't yield better forecasts than our simple no-change rule. The truth is that forecasting oil prices is so darn hard that complicated formulae add nothing but complexity. And so the simple forecasting rule also turns out to be the best. Don't you wish that all of economics was this easy?
Yes, we do. Justin Wolfers teaches at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. Let us know what's on your mind. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. The center of the video gaming universe right now is here in Los Angeles. Anybody who's anybody is at the E3 conference this week, including a guy named Will Wright. Wright's the mastermind behind one of the most popular online games ever, The Sims, it's called. But it came out 8 years ago, and diehard gamers have been waiting for the follow-up ever since. In an already big year for games, Wright's newest creation is set to be released next month by Electronic Arts. George Jones is with GamePro Media. George, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right, I have to ask you about what I'm told is the big thing this year. So we've had Grand Theft Auto, and we've had all the rest of those. And then there's this thing called Spore? Help me understand that.
So Spore is, it's kind of like a a life simulator. I mean, at its very core, you start the game as a single cell organism, and the goal is to reproduce asexually. So,
well, that takes all the fun out of it. But anyway,
yeah, it's not that fun. Then it gets more fun later. So then, you know, you go from a single cell organism to a creature, and then you go from a creature to a society of creatures. And then you go from a society to creatures to an interplanetary, you know, society that, you know, spans galaxies.
So you get to be God, basically.
Yeah, it's pretty trippy. There's nothing like it.
So it launches in September, but EA has released this sort of precursor game, I guess, called Creature Creator. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's the Creature Creator, and it released, I guess, 3 or 4 weeks ago to a considerable amount of hoopla. It basically allows you to create your creature. It's pretty interesting.
You have it here. We have a laptop in the studio. We're going to fire this thing up, the Creature Creator, and try to make it make some sense.
Okay, I'll run it, and then you can give me your creative input.
All right, perfect.
Okay, so...
So what are we looking at?
So the first thing you see is this kind of blob. I just call it like a nascent blob.
And it truly is. It's a formless little...
It's a formless thing. What it does is it has a vertebrae. So we can take the vertebrae and we can move it, we can shape it, we can
and we can pull the neck up as you're doing.
Yep, and you can elongate it. Then you can take a series of different heads and mouths, and we can put it on there. So which one of these do you like?
That one right there.
This one?
Yeah.
All right.
So it actually looks a little bit like it's called the Crockhead. It's a little bit of a crocodile elongated, you know, snapping jaw thing.
Yep. And we can also put eyes. So maybe we'll do some eyes first.
All right, get some scary looking eye.
All right.
So that one right there.
Okay, all right.
The lizard eye on the crocodile.
So here we go. You can go one eye or two.
I want three eyes.
Let's
see. You do three eyes?
I'm
come
pretty
on.
Sure you can. Let's see.
If I'm going to play God, I want three eyes. All right, so we get our creature fully created and formed, and as of right now, there's nothing we can do with it game-wise, right?
That's exactly right.
Okay, but in September when Spore launches, this will be the Genesis creature for us, right? We'll start and we'll go from there.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, though. How is EA going to make money with people playing around with these creatures?
So I asked Lucy this specifically.
Lucy is?
She's the general manager at EA's Electronic Arts Maxis studio, who's making this game. And she told me that initial sales will count for, you know, probably a lot of revenue right up front. But then what EA has learned, and they learned this with The Sims, which was, you know, the previous game in this kind of category, is that after the game's released, you can make a fortune by selling add-on packs and add-on content that
New territories and
new territories, new kind of parts of creatures, new themes, new worlds, you know, and you know, the cost of those, that content is small, you know, so it'll be
sure.
It'll be maybe $20.
What about this as compared to other, you know, creation games? Why is this one special?
There's really two or three key reasons. And I think the first is this, the notion that you're going from a single cell organism to a spacefaring people is wild. But I think more importantly than that, this game has a interesting online presence. So the creatures you create, they go into other people's games. He has this thing called procedural gaming thing. So it's, we create this creature, we have it in our game. It's automatically uploaded to this kind of universe of other creatures. So when my civilization goes into space, we're going to encounter your creature that you just built. This is no one's ever done anything like this. The fact that you could actually kind of participate in this big kind of multiplayer experience without actively participating in it is very unique.
George Jones is the editorial director at GamePro Media. George, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, it is safe to eat tomatoes again. This afternoon, the Food and Drug Administration lifted its salmonella warning on tomatoes. It didn't say the outbreak is over, though, just that tomatoes aren't suspected anymore. Jalapeno and serrano peppers are, so shop carefully. The FDA says it's sending inspectors to a packing house in Mexico that it's got some concerns about. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow jumped 207 points, 1.8%. The NASDAQ rose 27 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 bumped up 11 points. That's about 0.9% there. Kevin Arnovitz, Steve Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Coming up next time, some unlikely risks to the Olympic Games.
Green peppers, olives, onions, pepperoni.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.